This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for July 9th, 2019. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels, and I am tremendously glad you're here. We are in a new space right now. Can you tell? You probably can, because we're still working on soundproofing it properly, which I think is important if you're recording stuff in a space. What do I know? I don't know. Anyway, this episode we are talking to Juan Vaca. By we, I mean me. I am talking to Juan Vaca. You may know his work from some of the great latter-day Telltale games, like the Batman game and like Minecraft Story Mode Season 2, stuff that flew under a lot of people's radar because Telltale was already going into a little bit of a spiral at that point as an organization. We do not, by the way, talk about the actual drama around Telltale's closing because Juan sort of left before all that went down. And anyway, that stuff has been very well covered in, for example, that very good recent NoClip documentary, which I will link to in the show notes. We do talk about his design time at Telltale and how he cut his teeth on narrative design there. We talk about his work after that at Endless Entertainment, and we talk a bit about his current role in the interactive division team Brain Trust at Netflix. Juan, you know, in the same way we don't talk about the Telltale closure stuff, we don't talk scoops as far as what Netflix is currently working on, interactive entertainment-wise, but we do talk about why the format is interesting to Juan, what Netflix has done so far. We also talk about his time in the military, his life as a veteran, his work with Latinx in Gaming, organization that he's been working with for about 2 years, which is how long it's existed. It's a good interview, I think, and Juan does a better job describing his career and his thoughts on narrative than I would. So here is Juan Vaca.
No,
not a problem.
1, 2, 3, drinking my tea.
Oh man, I didn't know I was getting free poetry. That's going to be great. That's perfect.
Okay, cool.
Sweet. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really, really appreciate it. I know you are doing a lot always, but especially right now. So thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for inviting me on board.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, so there's a lot of incredible stuff you do and have done, and I assume are going to do. Maybe the right place to start, though, is to talk about your new gig. I know you recently, quite recently actually, joined Netflix to work on their interactive stuff. Yeah. So if you wouldn't mind, could you just describe like what your role is there, and if you can talk about it, you know, what you're working on so far?
So essentially, Netflix has been putting out interactive content. We have, I think, 6 titles right now. The most recent one is You Versus Wild, which is like a Bear Grylls choose your own adventure kind of back and forth. The next one, I think right before that, that gained a lot of momentum was Bandersnatch by mm-hmm. Black Mirror. And I think, you know, that was a big point in, you know, realizing what the future of entertainment looks like with these interactive choose your own stories, you know, like your investment of entertainment and experience is kind of catered to what you're, you know, wanting to happen in the story. So it's kind of this like hybrid game movie interactive experience. And
it's Black Mirror, so it's immediately extremely on the nose about what it is. Like there's the opening scene, your first big choice is what cereal to have, and the characters are having a discussion about choose your own adventure books. Like it immediately becomes about itself in a way that is weirdly appropriate for a lot of people's introduction to the form.
Right. And so a lot of what we're doing is they want to invest more in creating this type of content. So my background is interactive storytelling. Prior to this, I worked at a startup called Endless Entertainment. We made interactive choose your own adventure stories for a mobile phone. Prior to that, I was at Telltale for like 6 years, and we made interactive, you know, choose your own adventure type branched content. So I'm bringing my background in storytelling, game design, to Netflix to help really boost the content of what we're doing. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, to sort of bridge the gap, one of the interactive things on Netflix currently is a Telltale joint. Is it just the first season or all of it? But anyway, it's Minecraft story mode, right?
Correct. That's also the first season. I actually was one of the lead designers on the second season. And so while my content isn't necessarily there, it's really nice to see all the stuff that we created still alive and enjoyed by many people, like on the servers.
Definitely. And I feel like a lot of the Telltale back catalog could be a pretty good fit down the road. You know, I mean, Minecraft seems like the right place to start because it seems like a fair bit of it, not Bandersnatch, but a fair bit of it is pitched at kids. There's Bobby Thunderstruck.
Oh, yeah, Buddy Thunderstruck.
Yeah, stop motion comedy stuff with lots of farts and silly decisions and like that. You know, that's great. You know, it fits very much into that lane, Minecraft story mode, I mean, you know, so yeah. That makes total sense to start, but you could absolutely, I mean, even Bandersnatch makes use of what I think of as the Telltale fuse, right? That timer for your decisions. And it sort of uses it to make the FMV aspect seamless or pretty close to seamless. But the fact that mechanic is built into the interface means, you know, with the exception, I guess, of like the sort of button mashy stuff, right? It's set up to do most of the core mechanics of Telltale games, the decisions being the most important ones.
Absolutely. You know, and a lot of thought goes into that, like choice space, choice point moment. You know, I think that was where, you know, I personally excel at. You know, I try to find like, what are the balanced choices? You know, what are the things that resonate? How can we make this a choice that, you know, telegraphs what you're about to do, but also tells you what you're missing out on, you know, through the other absence? Because we only have a couple seconds for you to actually make a decision. But I think that inner turmoil that you experience is something very relatable, depending on the situation you're in. And I think that's kind of where the, like, pressures of, you know, stress kind of bring you to being aligned with the character, and it creates like really beautiful player agency when done right.
Absolutely. I know a lot of people sort of fell in love with Telltale because of The Walking Dead season one, and that to me is a masterclass in making you make, you know, questionable decisions because of fear or pressure or something like that. And that's what a lot of the Telltale stuff did so well. Bandersnatch is more about the, you know, underlining the irrelevance of the decisions sometimes or whatever, right. Or just, you know, following down pathways, and all of that stuff's possible. I find it really interesting because it is minimally interactive in a certain sense. There's no real execution challenge, at least to the way it's currently presented on the Netflix stuff. Some of the Telltale stuff arguably had execution challenges with puzzles or, again, like the just hit cue really fast kind of stuff. But the barrier to entry as far as playing a game is so low. And, you know, that's especially important, I feel like, on this podcast, because a ton of people who listen to us are people who play games, like thinking about games or interested in games, but would not in any sense describe themselves as gamers, certainly not with, you know, a capital G. So opening up space where all these different people who are interested in the form can sort of meet and try new things and see new things is great to me.
Yeah, like I think, you know, I've been in the industry for 7 years, maybe. And there's nothing that my parents, who are immigrants and kind of tech unsavvy, would be able to play. You know, like they don't have Steam accounts. They're not going to download the app to the iPhone and play for 2 hours. You know, they don't have consoles. So in a way, I kind of have been steering my way to kind of make stuff more accessible, right? Like what is the game that you can design for your parents to play? And in this way, instead of it being like the small thing that you make with cardboard and crayons that you put on the fridge, you know, this is some work that everybody's putting together as teams to make content that we put on the TV for everyone to experience. So I think by making this accessible, we can kind of like unify, like you said, the people that are trying to have fun, trying to escape, that don't necessarily need to invest into a console or the current of, you know, what being a gamer really means, which, I mean, it doesn't really mean anything, like,
right,
like there's no wrong way to game, there's no wrong way to play. I think there's a lot of gatekeeping that's being done, and it's for naught, you know, like we're all having fun. I think that's the most beautiful part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I really love short circuiting that stuff, you know, cause the gatekeeping is usually, there's no way to say this without sounding a little arch, I guess, but it's not generally done by the people who are actually the most invested in the form. You know, the people who are interested in the history and play a bunch of different stuff. It's usually done by people who on some level feel like their position in the culture is a bit more precarious, and that's why they have to defend their turf or something, you know? Yeah. Bandersnatch, again, like super low interactivity, but has references to, you know, they talk about Get Lamp and, you know, things like that. So it's mm-hmm. very plugged into the culture that it comes from.
It knows what it's doing.
Yeah. I mean, and there's, you know, there's nothing more very online than Minecraft story mode. Like it's absolutely ensconced in a game culture that maybe doesn't have as much to do with capital G gamer culture as some people are comfortable with, you know, because I think when I first heard about the concept of Minecraft story mode, I think Rock Paper Shotgun commented on this too. It sounded like an absurd idea. It sounded like Telltale shooting the moon and doing the most impossible thing they could possibly do. But when I talk to kids, you know, teenagers or younger now, the idea of there being a story in Minecraft doesn't seem strange at all, because there sort of is an ongoing narrative that they build themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you played Minecraft, but
Back in alpha when it was a super hardcore thing that only complete nerds did before it was a worldwide phenomenon. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I don't think I started playing it until I was at Telltale, actually. So maybe like 2013, 2014. And I played with a couple of friends, and they all were just like, yeah, let's play. Like, we'll jump on the server. And it became kind of like a social experience, you know?
Totally.
You know, we'd build a house, and, you know, because they had played before, they knew exactly where to go and bring back loot and just drop things off and be like, here you go, have some iron. And, you know, we kind of created like a small house and community, and I went exploring. And when I was a lead designer at Telltale, I used a lot of those experiences and like the stuff that like happens with your friends online to kind of like dictate like where the story goes, right? Because Minecraft is just the setting that allows us to have, you know, these unique mechanics. But when you're really telling stories, you're actually, you know, relying more on like the characters and the emotions and the troubles that they have and how it all affects you and how what you say and do kind of can steer how the situation presents itself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, there's something to diving into a world where the mechanics are either something the audience already knows or something you can understand really quickly, like sort of the rules of the world, but where there aren't a huge, you know, it's not Batman or something, you know, another fine Telltale series that I believe you worked on, where the characters are loaded down with this whole history. Minecraft isn't really like that, which gives you a lot of room to tell whatever kind of stories you want to in that space, or indeed in any space.
Oh, for sure. You know, and like a lot of credit goes to the team that worked on that in the first season, you know, really trying to crack that nut and figure out like what is the right type of story and humor and, you know, challenges to present itself. So like, I think they did a really great job of setting the foundation.
Absolutely,
for a very vibrant world.
Yeah, I mean, so this in some sense is what you've done for a while, right? You worked at Marvel for a bit on sort of licensing, not gatekeeping, but checking to make sure stuff was on brand and in world. And then when you were talking about Endless Entertainment, your series app was very much about telling original stories in worlds people are familiar with, right?
Oh, so absolutely. Like, yeah, so like I actually really learned a lot of it back at Marvel, where I was a intern in their games department in Manhattan Beach. And so no games were actually made there. But all the developers that were making any type of Marvel game came
from. And there are a lot of types of Marvel game, right? So that's
absolutely
a lot.
Absolutely, so many. I mean, we had a social department, which was just like the Facebook games. And like the MMO that I think was being developed at the time. then we had the mobile department, and that was like all the apps, you know, any type of Marvel mobile game, like went through, you know, one guy. And then we also had the console division, which was like anything that came out on any console. So like I was playing an Avengers game that never got released. That was like kind of like a Left 4 Dead kind of spinoff where all four of you were like characters. Like you had your own powers and abilities. So that got locked away in the vault. There's like some Spider-Man games that I worked on. Because I think The Amazing Spider-Man was coming out. So they were always making like a parallel movie to a game kind of a thing.
Totally, totally. So when that thread, that wasn't intended to be a spider pun, but when that version of Peter Parker kind of got put on the shelf, the game did too.
No. The games came out.
Oh, gotcha. So okay, like, but you're saying you were working on it. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I worked on, I think, the Game Boy Advance version of the game, which, you know, when you play a prototype, you're basically playing like gray boxes, and it's mm-hmm. usually pretty buggy. But, you know, you kind of have to play it for, you know, the list of what Marvel cares about. And it's like, okay, understand these characters. Are they, you know, in line with who they are? And so growing up reading comics, watching cartoons, watching movies, like I really identified and like understood these people as if they were my neighbor. And so I treated like the stories and everything with such a like respect, and tried to make sure that everything is in line with the rules of that universe. So sometimes it would be like franchise, like legal stuff. For instance, you know, certain licenses belong to certain companies, and certain characters and certain universes aren't allowed to cross, kind of like, you know, how, you know, the X-Men belong to Fox and Universal, but, you know, the Avengers belong to Disney, but you never see them in the same movie universe kind of a thing.
Right.
So the same thing, same concept for games, except in games, because everything is kind of so like secretive, other people don't know what other people are working on. And you can't tell them why they can't use certain characters. So they'd have a great idea and be like, oh, I want to use Mr. Sinister as the, you know, villain for this. And it'd be like, oh, that's great, but you can't, because this other team is using them for, you know, XYZ.
For undisclosed Project X that I cannot say another word about. Yeah. That's gotta be doubly frustrating in a way, because you don't even like, you're denied the knowledge that it's, oh, well, at least what they're making might be cool. Like, you just have no idea. It's gotta be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so while I was there, you know, part of the work was also try to fill out the universe with these extended characters. And so there was another game in production that I was literally going into the Wikipedia pages of like Marvel and looking up these like secondary, tertiary characters, and taking them out of like whatever like historical issue they were in and bringing them into the game as like, you know, scientist A is no longer, you know, generic scientist, but rather this particular person from this one comic issue. So, you know, for the casual person, it might not, you know, be something you notice, but for the person that means something, like that could be like a really nice call out. And so little things like that also were part of my job. I ended up writing a couple storylines that ended up getting into the game. And so that was kind of cool, getting my first writing credit like on Spider-Man as an intern.
That's amazing. Especially having grown up reading comics, and from what I've heard, like you had like a pretty special relationship with comics, right? Because you've said in other interviews you grew up poor, so you would have to just blaze through a comic like standing in the shop. You didn't know how to like go home to your shrine or something. Yeah. So it's kind of amazing to blaze through a bunch of projects and like have your iron in a lot of fires and stuff. But then B, to get to write for the characters that you had that special like bond with growing up is amazing.
Yeah, and you know, it was very surreal because you know, there were certain games that would come in and it was just, you know, very flat, like spec documents. And I remember there was a Kinect fighting game where it kind of just mimicked your moves, like Just Dance, but you would
Could be so good or so bad. Oh man.
I think it was called Avengers Battle for Earth. But when we received the document, it was just like, here's like a couple of the moves, and it was like high punch, low punch, you know, and I was just like, no,
the iconic Spider-Man
cool.
low punch. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool sounding. You know, we should do like a sling or berserker or like whatever kind of like action verbs we can do to kind of push what these things are. You know, I really learned a lot in my time at Marvel. There's some like marvelous people. Oh shit. I didn't mean to cuss.
You can totally swear. It's fine. Don't worry about
there's that. Some really great people there. And I still stay in touch with them. And as funny enough, as the world, you know, spins, by the time I flash forward to 2015, I believe, and I was working on Batman at Telltale, three of us from Marvel were in the writer's room, now working on the Batman game. So like Randy Ma was at Marvel when I was there, and then he was now doing the same job for DC. TQ was the vice president, I believe, at Marvel, and he was the executive producer on Batman. So there was like a lot of just like, you know, when people say it's a small industry and you'll see each other again, like that's very literal, you know, like there's not a lot of people that do what we do. And so you're going to see him at the same like events, you know, PAX, E3, GDC. It's a really great community.
Yeah, it is still, I mean, there's a massive scene of interactive fiction, but sort of the specific lane of, you know, the Telltale style, like that, you know, the Telltale, I guess the Telltale in its heyday was sort of a renaissance of a style anyway, right? But that and its immediate progeny are a relatively small corner. So in an industry where you run into people a lot under any circumstances, I totally can see how that'd be doubly true with the kind of interactive, you know, like narrative design, you know, using licensed worlds and characters kind of thing. Like that's got to be a pretty tight knit group, all things considered.
Yeah, absolutely. I've really enjoyed my time, you know, playing with these universes and understanding characters and like looking at like, what does it really mean to, you know, be in this world, or what are their problems, or what are the things that we want to see? And that's kind of the stuff that I took into Endless when we were working on series, and we got to, you know, write, say, like our own Saved by the Bell game, which is basically like writing our own season of the sitcom.
My wife was super stoked to play the Law and Order one, because she's a big Law and Order person. So yeah, to get to have it, like, it was agonizing to decide whether to spend the gems on investigating the crime scene more thoroughly or having a cup of coffee with Lenny Brisco, because you're definitely there to do both. Yeah, I enjoyed those a fair bit.
Yeah, and I also got a chance to write the sequel to 16 Candles. So
I did, like, not get a chance to play that one before the interview, but I noticed that you did that, and I got to check it out.
I had a lot of fun. You know, I think that was a really great exercise in, you know, taking a movie, you know, dissecting it, you know, finding out like what is a similar storyline, who are the key characters that we want to interact with. And, you know, there was a article that Molly Ringwald did, I think, an op-ed on about, like, you know, what happens in that movie, because a lot of the things in that movie do not hold up to this day. And
is that the one about showing it to her kid, or like deciding whether to do so? Yeah.
You know, and so I, you know, talked with, you know, the other writers and the showrunner, and, you know, we said, like, you know, there are things in this movie that are, you know, troubling, unsettling, and we, you know, we need to steer clear of that. But I think we also can address those issues and, you know, use interactive fiction to kind of bring those scenarios up. But instead of it happening in a flat, you know, linear way for a character in the story, Let's put you in the driver's seat. So, you know, I think when we took a look from a distance at, you know, what are the things in this story that are happening? What are the, you know, problematic things? How can we bring them up, but also address them? I think it was one of like the funnest things that I like really enjoyed working on.
That's fantastic. And it's, to me, that's, there's a lot of value in that. You know, first of all, games, as like you say, a space to work that stuff out and think it through in a useful way. But also the idea that when there's this historic work, this important work, right? Not historic, it's not that damn old, right? But something people have a lot of connection to, nostalgia, emotional attachment, whatever, but that has stuff that we shouldn't ignore, that you don't have to ignore it, nor do you have to leave the work on the shelf or in the dustbin of history or whatever. You can take it down and you can look at it carefully and you can address, redress that stuff. I mean, fan fiction has been doing this forever.
Absolutely.
You know? I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I do, you know, like I'm just a professional fanfic, you know, designer, you know,
the series app in particular has that, that whiff about it. Right. And I don't mean that in a negative way at all. I mean that like, just the fact that you as the player are creating an original character to interact with these characters that you're very familiar with. The character can sort of look like you, or maybe not like you, but like someone who you wish was in the story or that you wish you could play as or something like that. And again, it's expanding on what was interesting about those stories in the first place and those worlds and those characters, while maybe modernizing is not quite the right word, right? But revisiting and revising and re-exploring that stuff.
For sure.
Yeah. No, it's really neat. I'm a big, big fan of your work. And I'm also, I gotta say, because I was listening to everything you've done before, I'm a big, big fan of just like the way you talk about yourself. I know that's a strange thing to say, but like you've had a pretty interesting life so far. You've talked a fair bit, for example, about your time in the military.
Oh yeah.
And I think you talk about it in a way that I'm not used to because it's so nuanced, if that makes sense, because of where and when and how and in what socioeconomic class I grew up. I didn't grow up knowing that many people who, you know, going into the military was on their radar. So to hear you talk about the good things about it and the way you feel like it gave you a work ethic and all of that kind of stuff or fostered your work ethic, not that you didn't have one before, but then also that you're pretty open about, for example, the fact that you got kind of, you know, at best misled, maybe straight up lied to or deceived by a recruiter.
Yeah.
And sort of the ways you dealt with the hierarchy that didn't feel productive or good or any of those things. The fact that you talk about it holistically that way in interviews with other veterans, you know, in public, I'll link to an interview where you sort of tell the whole saga. I won't make you retell it here.
Oh, sure.
But that to me seems super valuable because that's something that I think the rest of American culture doesn't talk about, or at least doesn't talk about literally. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, like, there is definitely this, you know, military fetishization that is, you know, the government pays for it to kind of like support the troops, you know, but the best way to support them is to keep them alive, you know, to not
send them into pointless conflicts. Yeah.
You know, then, you know, it should say support the veterans, you know, like I think, you know, the troops, as hard as they have it, they have no idea what's going to happen after their sustainment, and the world and the military does not prepare them for that. So I think by, you know, saying support the troops, you're kind of neglecting the secondary and tertiary ramifications of, you know, everything that happens to like all these people that are constantly getting out of the service and trying to reintegrate into a society that, you know, they may not have, you know, be ready for that level of autonomy. You know, the military, you know, indoctrinates you in a very heavy way that it's just like, I'm going to pay you on the 1st and 15th. I'm going to provide for your food and housing. That will be always taken care of. You know, you don't have to worry about what you're going to wear every day because you're going to wear your uniform and you're going to show up and work with the same people, and you just build this cadence, you know, and you're just like, this is what I do every day. And then to kind of basically be then like, okay, and now that's ending and gone. And you realize like how alone you are, right? Because when you were in the service, it was like, oh, I was part of this, you know, Marines, I was part of this army, I was part of the Navy, I was part of this bigger entity. And once you remove yourself from that, like that entity continues, right? Like the Marine Corps is still alive very well today. But I am no longer in it, right? I don't have that safety net. In fact, that safety net was actually rejected like from me, or as I was getting out and I knew that I wasn't going to redeploy or extend, I got orders that basically said, you know, Sergeant Vaca, you now have to report to 29 Palms to this unit. And then you'll be there for 3 years. And after that, you know, you'll be deployed with them wherever they go. And I was like, hey, like, I don't think I'm gonna do that. I get out in like a year and a half. I don't want to, you know, go to California to not be able to deploy because I don't have enough time left on my contract. So I denied the orders. And it's kind of like a big deal, you know, like you're literally saying no to an order. But the way in which it was handled, I think, was very, you know, gruesome and grotesque. But that's kind of the toxicity of, you know, what the military is. My first sergeant, you know, made it very clear. And he was like, are you sure you want to deny these? And I was just like, yeah, I'm getting out. Like, of course. And then he said, you know, I'm going to make sure that you never get promoted. And I'm going to make sure that you can't come back in. Right. So, you know, wow. For saying no, I was no longer, you know, welcome or even wanting to return, you know, and this is the, you know, the brotherhood that you are supposedly like entering. And this is like, you know, your direct manager boss who actually doesn't even know me because I never saw the guy, you know? So like, it was just a very like, you know, gross and sad, you know, parting. But, you know, like I knew that that's not what I wanted to do. And so I got out. And, you know, and like I said, like, you know, leaving the Marine Corps is a lot like leaving prison. You know, you look behind you and you see those gates close and it's you and your suitcases and the open road.
And for a lot of people, yourself included, right, it's that had been your entire adult life up to that point.
Yeah, you know, like 8 years. I gave my, I guess, like the, like from 18 to 26, you know, and looking back at it, it was a very challenging time. I still can't believe I did a lot of that stuff, you know, and it's not until like I really think about like, oh yeah, you know, I went to sniper school and I have like all these memories of it. But also like, oh yeah, I deployed, you know, with an 8-man team at 22. And I was just like, what were my friends doing at 22? And like just this like correlation of, you know, how surreal it sometimes feels. But you kind of have to have, you know, those blinders on so that you can focus. But then once you are done and you take those blinders off, like it can be very unsettling. And, you know, I think that's, I think one of the problems with, a lot of veterans these days. I hope that there's a, you know, better solution in place to prepare them for the world. But a lot of what is being done is essentially just us, you know, other veterans volunteering to take care of other veterans and, you know, line up to, you know, do races or do good work or volunteer or play games together. Like, we're noticing that we have to take care of ourselves because no one's coming for us.
Which is insane in a country that so frequently says support our troops. Like, what does, to your point, what does support our troops mean if it doesn't mean that? If it doesn't mean see if the veterans in your community are okay. If it doesn't mean hire a veteran, if it doesn't mean, you know, mental health for people who come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, straight up, you know, healthcare for people who come back with injuries, or like if it doesn't mean that, then all it means is don't question stuff, which is not the best message to hammer in a democracy, probably.
Right. Because I mean, okay, so I particularly work in the power of words, right? When you pick these
kind of choices, by the way,
right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, what are you saying in this stuff? And so, like, let's dissect that, right? Like, you know, support the troops, right? Does that mean that by not following the statement, you're clearly not supporting the troops, you know? So it kind of gives you this kind of intent that is willed upon you, and you can't say no, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, when
it's a mantra.
Yeah, kind of like when, you know, your grandma's like, here, eat some more food. And you're just like, but I'm actually full. It's just like, sure. Well, are you going to say no to grandma and no to food? Like,
no, definitely not.
It kind of puts that, you know, that invisible weight on you.
Yeah. It's a weight that obviously far less, but to a certain degree, even people who've never been in the military feel like that cultural weight of how this is that sphere that, because I don't know that much about it, except, you know, secondhand from listening to you and reading and listening to other people and meeting people and all that, I sometimes feel like there are aspects of it I'm not qualified to comment on. And in fact, if I say anything online or in person in some places in this country, you know, saying maybe we shouldn't go to place X or deploy our military there, the reaction I get is sometimes, well, you have no idea because you're not a military person. You're not from a military family, at least, you know, and that's true to a certain extent, but it's also, it seems like it needs to be a solvable problem if we're going to live in a society.
Also counter that and say, you can say, and you have no idea, only have that perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
Like, you know, the people that are holding the flashlight are sometimes in the darkness themselves.
Mm.
Like, there's not a way for us to, communicate if we're only like pointing the finger and immediately dismissing each other. Like, you know, I think it's just it's why I work in choices and games and stories, because like I really think that we can use that as a lens to try something different, see something that maybe we can connect. And you know, one or two little differences here and there, I think can go a long ways.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and absolutely. So living in someone else's shoes, one of the most important things a story, especially an interactive story, can do. Thinking about choices, playing out the way you interact with systems, all that stuff. And also just thinking about symbols, like really engaging with a story is just an exercise in remembering that things mean things, which is something that I feel like we forget sometimes just casually. That sounds so strange to say, but there's this certain denial that anything below the surface actually exists, that, you know, what's the quote from one of the Game of Thrones showrunners, that, you know, themes are for 8th grade book reports, you know, themes don't natively exist in stories or something. A well-told story makes it impossible to believe that, because you are thinking about stuff. I don't think you can't write a Batman story without writing a little bit about cities or mental health or something, you know?
Yeah, no, 100% wrong. I think themes are the most important and powerful things we have. I think that is the invisible through line that, you know, connects, makes all the things in your story, like, connect the dots for the audience. In fact, like I said, like, my Minecraft episode was about friendship, you know, and that was the theme. And so, like, there are 5 major choices that every Telltale game had to have, right? Like, the big 5 choices.
The ones that where you see how other people chose as compared to you at the end of the episode, yeah.
And all of mine were about friendship, you know? It was some way or another, like, you know, do you trust your friend's advice when everything is in danger? Do you promise to be friends even after, you know, even if your paths are not going to align? You know, do you trust another friend to stay behind, or do you want to, like, protect them and bring them with you? You know, like I think everything just feels a little bit sweeter when it's all, from the same sugar dish, I guess.
Like, when a story has something on its mind, I think even people who are not writing an essay about it or thinking about it consciously still sort of notice when a story is cohesive or coherent in that way.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think themes are important because, you know, that is the foundation that you set for your audience to experience something. Like, that is the connective tissue for what you're making. I mean, otherwise you'll end up with something like disjointed and really more of like an anthology of stuff that's happening.
Yeah. And the result can be very similar to something that, rather than not having any conscious theme, has 20, you know what I mean? Like some unambitious mess. Like, I don't know why Southland Tales immediately came to mind. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but
I have not.
It's a 3-hour plus, magnum opus by the same director as Donnie Darko. And it's got too much on its mind, right? Like it's totally incoherent. It's never boring, but boy, is it, I mean, it's, I can't call it a good movie, but it's definitely an interesting movie.
Right.
That can happen too. And those can be interesting works of art, but they don't tend to be the ones that resonate in quite the same way as something that, like you said, all comes from the same sugar dish.
You know, and like, that is still also just like the way that I tell stories, right? Like that's my flavor of storytelling, right? Like if I was a chef, that would be like, you know, my unique flavor. I think, you know, there's no, like, you can be any kind of storyteller, you know. I think there are some key things that, you know, like writers that get it, like always offer, and there's always room to improve. But it is a craft and it is a muscle, and there are things that you kind of just set yourself up for and like you really understand. And that's why, you know, mostly mystery writers just write mysteries, or, you know, romance authors just write romance.
Because each one of those is really hard to write, and there's a very specific craft to it, and it's the rare author who can really master more than one. A lot of people just refine a craft. It makes complete sense.
Yeah, and you know, finding your niche, finding what you're good at, it's nice, you know. And like I think, that's really up to people to kind of experiment with. I went to film school, and even though I was game and interactive entertainment major, you had to go through some of the basic, you know, film boot camp classes. And one of them was one where you basically made 5 movies over the course of a semester. So you had a 3-week rotation where you were either writing a movie, you were shooting a movie, or you were editing a movie. And then you'd screen them, and then you'd start over. Write, shoot, edit. And that's the time that I basically like used my experimentation. And the best part was you weren't allowed to use any dialogue.
Oh, that's amazing.
So it's strictly visual storytelling. And you know, I was like, all right, let me try a couple different things. I wrote a rom-com. I did a mystery kind of suspense. I did a comedy. And then I did a documentary. For your last one, you were allowed to actually like have dialogue. And the documentary that I did was about one of my friends just talking about, you know, what it's like to be a dad. And, you know, in the small, just like visions of like him telling his stories, like I think he did a lot of growth and he like realized that like on screen, and I'm just talking to him as a friend. I didn't really go in with a actual like plan. It was really more just like, you know, this guy has so many great stories. Like, I just want to hear him and like, you know, cut and put together something, and then I'll find the theme, right? Out of all the little stories that he told, you know, I kind of, you know, picked them up, looked at them, and put them back in order in a way that made it more cohesive and really told a message. And then at the end, you know, showed his character journey. And people were crying at the end of like a student film.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Does that live online anywhere, or is that something because it's
I have it
work,
on my
you
hard
don't...
drive. Okay. I think I'm going to share it.
That'd be awesome. I would watch that for sure.
Yeah, I still talk to my friend every once in a while. So you know, I'd want to talk to him first and see if he minds putting it up there before I put anything up.
Obviously super fair. I mean, yeah, documentary is always a space where that particular thing's interesting. And it's also a really great way of talking about how theme can be emergent, right? I think when a lot of people reject the idea that stories natively have themes, what they're rejecting is the idea that there is a mastermind putting a message into a story to communicate it. That isn't really what it means. It just means that by the time the work is complete, it has a point of view about the thing it's about. And sometimes Absolutely. That can happen pretty organically.
Yep. And, you know, often than not, I mean, I don't know a single writer I might have read a couple of books online, but most of them like get more than like one pass of edits, right? Like somebody should be giving you feedback and telling you like, cut this, like get this, because things are off the path or aren't motivated.
With
or
long form fiction, oh boy,
it.
Can you tell when no one did that? Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. And that's, I was going to say the whole emergent theme thing. It's one of the reasons it's important to just get different kinds of storytellers, people who've had different lives, different points of view, different backgrounds, different identities, all those kinds of things, which I didn't mean to cut you off, but I was going to say that kind of leads me really neatly to the other thing you do, which is the Latinx in Gaming group, where mm-hmm. you sort of mentor and bring into the fold other Latinx folks who want to be involved in games, because I think it's, as in all media, it's an underrepresented group. And I think there's inherent value in just getting all kinds of different voices involved. And I think what you do is super cool. So I wanted to make sure to bring it up.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah, it's a movement that is, I think, in its second, it's in its second year. We started in January of 2018. I got an email from Jen McLean at the time, which was the IGDA executive director, and she said that Christina Amaya and Judy Barbosa were looking to start a special interest group for Latinx folks and interest in gaming. And we had a conversation, you know, where it was like, all right, here's the meet these two strangers. And over the course of emails, you know, we started talking about like, what is it that we want to do? What do we define it? Who do we allow? Not necessarily who do we allow in, but like, what does it mean, right? Like, I ran through the exact same exercise of, you know, what does it mean to look at these words? Like, is it Latinos in gaming? Is it Latinas in gaming?
Correct me if I'm wrong. The Twitter handle actually ended up being Latinos in Gaming because you were still right. working out the name. Yeah.
Yep. So like the OG title is still there, you know, and we
which that's actually, proper. That's proper Spanish, but it has gendered implications that are not as inclusive as they could be. Right.
Right. You know, and the same thing, you know, if it was called Latinas in Gaming, you know, then some people would be like, oh, I can't be a part of that because I'm not a Latina. But they don't have that problem when it's a Latino. So we understood that by using also the X, not only was it more inclusive, but then that X could mean more things, right? Not just, you know, the gendered pronouns of the language, but rather, you know, how Latin are you and why this place is for you? And, you know, I think that was kind of the cornerstone of our message, which was it all counts.
Yeah.
You know, like 1%, you know, Latin is Latin.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's a uniquely useful word to think about in that context because it describes a diaspora, first of all, but it also sort of resists any really simple categorization. It can't just be about speaking Spanish, for example, because that excludes people who are second, third generation and aren't raised right. speaking Spanish. It excludes people yeah. in Brazil, you know, like any, that's just one example among like a dozen, right? And you actually did a really good roundtable, which I'll link to, but it's a great word to think about the expansiveness of.
Yeah. So we basically use that as our platform. And then we also realized we need to also lower the bar for the in-gaming part of it, right?
Oh, interesting. Like, yeah.
We don't want it just to be developers. Like, we are a community, you know? So if it doesn't matter where you're from or what you look like, it also shouldn't matter what you do, right? Like there is the one love that unifies us, and you will find someone in there that shares that type of story with you. So we opened it up to developers, media, streamers, tabletop, and even just like gamers, like people that are, that just want to play. And so we took, you know, the message, and we created a forum. And at GDC, we had a really great roundtable where we shared these stories, and people were, you know, were, felt seen, and were emotional to connect with other people that had also felt out in the margins for the same reason. And we created a place for them, a place that includes them and wants them. And through that, we've made some really great like connections where people are now working on other people's projects internationally. You know, we've made friends in different countries. Like we're starting a program to try to connect South America with Latinx in gaming right now, and Central America, because we only have this, you know, US-based platform that we use. But there's so much more that can be done. But we kind of have to like reach out and have those conversations and create a place that the community can exist in.
Absolutely. I was not aware that it expanded to include, for example, streamers and journalists. That's incredible, especially because the lines so frequently get blurry these days. There's someone who starts at, you know, one of those more media focused things, but then tries their hand at making a game, and then lo and behold, they're still in their original lane, but perhaps they're in another as well. That's fantastic to open things up that way.
And it all counts, you know. I remember being on a panel about imposter syndrome at IndieCade, and a game developer he came up to me and he said, like, you know, I've always felt like I wasn't a real game developer. But I have 3 games out on the App Store. It's just like, well, come on, man. Like, you know, like
when are you going to be real? Come on now.
Yeah. Like you're already doing it, you know, give yourself the credit, you know?
And to be clear, I would say someone's a game developer if they have 0 games on the App Store, but absolutely, they're developing games. Like,
yeah. If you are designing a game, you are a game designer. Congratulations. I just knighted you. Like if you are working
first of
on
your
a
name,
game,
please rise. Yeah.
If you are working on a game, you're a game developer. It doesn't even have to be like, you know, in Unity or at paper prototype stage. Like if it's just a scratch pad, if it is like organically bouncing around in your head and you're just like, I don't know where to start. Like, surprise, you're a game developer. Like none of us do. None of us know where to start. You know, I was that, you know, Marine that just got out of the military, and I said, I want to make games. And that's where I started. So I Googled game schools and I did my research. And luckily enough, there was a program at my local community college. So that's where I started, you know, with no idea, knowing that I wanted to invest in games, a drive, and community college.
Yeah. And you know, that worked out pretty well for you, I dare say, right? Not that your path was easy. I don't mean to imply that, but you've found a niche and done exactly what it is you wanted to do, and figured out more exactly what it was you wanted to do along the way and done it.
Yeah. And it's very viable. It's hard, you know, and I think you do have to kind of set yourself, you definitely have to, you know, apply your work ethic and strategize and network and, you know, figure out how to make it to those places where you can be visible. But the second that you have something to show, like, that just makes you that much more valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you said the organization has existed about 2 years.
Right.
Has what you do day to day for it and what the organization does as a whole shifted as the scope has expanded, both, you know, both sides of the equation, the Latinx side and the in-game side? Because I know it was originally mostly about mentorship and giving information on how to get into the industry. Obviously, a streamer isn't necessarily interested in that kind of advice, or at least it's not the main thing they're interested in. Is it more just about bringing people together more broadly? Are there more specific sort of programs or initiatives going on? What is it? Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that is kind of, you know, what we're handling, like, under the hood. And remember when I said, like, you know, it was just three of us?
Yeah.
For the longest time, it was still just the three of us. And then we brought on board Elaine Gomez from Eline Media and Joe Tirado from Astroneer. And they have just been, like, an amazing effort of talent and leadership, helping us, you know, take on more projects, you know, like, and I think, you know, we've kind of made these kind of, you know, roles for ourselves so that one person's in charge of communications and the web page, another person's in charge of like streaming, and another one is PR, you know, and, you know, Chris and I, like, we try to organize, like, you know, panels. In fact, I spent last week putting together a panel for members in our community. You know, I organized like the pack submission stuff. I got them to say, okay, who wants to be on a panel? Come with me. If it's your first time, that's fine. Like, give them the platform. That's what we were talking about earlier with, like, whose stories are these to tell? And it's their own. You know, and when you hear it directly from them, that is better than me telling it secondhand. So we try to basically create a place that brings you into the community, empowers you, will give you a platform, will connect with you. And that all came from actually listening to what the community asked for. You know, this second year at our GDC talk, we said, you know, we were all here last year. Now what do we do this year? What is important to you? Like, we've got a good sustainment. Our message is no longer, look, we exist, but rather, what can we do?
Yeah. I had Rami Ishmael on here not too long ago, and I was just going to say, he talks about that problem a lot, that the more people you reach, the more unique problems, you know, worth solving you encounter, and you have to continually reevaluate how you approach a given problem.
Yeah. I mean, that is the design, you know, feedback cycle, you know, totally. That you have to iterate. Like, you have to listen to the problem, you have to listen to the audience. And so after the panel, people were like, it would be great if we had a suggestion box, it would be great if we had like channels for people in Spanish, channels for people that want to that have like visa issues or that need legal help, or how about one just for a specific, you know, support, like art support, coding support, design and writing support, you know, places for people to feel like the community just maybe even just wants to talk about what you're playing, or you want to build an audience to, for people to come watch your stream. There's something for you there. And I think that, you know, the community in itself is what's going to, you know, build itself, and we just have to listen and enable as leaders.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to be sensitive to your time because you have been super generous with it, and that's also a relatively good note to send people out on. But if there's anything else that you want to plug or talk about, or if you can talk about what you're working on right now, either in Linux, in gaming, or in Netflix, please feel free.
So right now I am working on adding more baritone horn to the Riverstown Skifflers, my jug band. Sorry, I had to plug my jug band.
I'm so glad you. I was gonna ask if I could use some of the jug band music in intros, outros. So that was gonna be my way
please
in.
Do.
But, oh, sweet. Yeah. Okay, I will. Yeah. Will do. I'm a fan. I didn't know about it until I started researching this interview, but I've been enjoying it a lot.
Oh yeah, actually, fun fact. Four of the people in the band are former Telltalers, including our lead band manager, band director, the very talented Mr. Jared Emerson Johnson. He is actually the composer for Bay Area Sound Design, which did all the stuff at Telltale. So
the band actually formed like on a Telltale email thread originally. Is that apocryphal, or did that actually happen?
That's it. You know, Jared sent an email out that said like a to the gang, to everyone, hey, I've always wanted to start a jug band. Is anybody interested?
And you ended up playing jug because you played low brass back in the day. Is that correct?
Yep.
So I have a sense of bass and
bass line and these lips.
That's amazing. That's amazing. It's a good sound, if I may say so myself.
Well, thank you. Self-taught.
I think I is there like jug school? I mean, there must be, right? There's got to be, like, if you go to the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago or something, they must have jug day.
But... I hope. Like, I actually had to like Google online, like, you know, how to play a jug, and I was just like, oh, well, this doesn't really feel like how I want to play it. And I think that, you know, going back, like, there's no wrong way to play. You just kind of have to figure out what is music for you.
If you were a chef and you were pouring from a jug, you'd have to find your own way that felt right to you to go back to the it was a strained metaphor, but yes.
There's a record store here where I live, and I was able to find in their like folk music section some jug music, not just any jug music, but literally the songs that we are playing today. And I got to go and listen to the vinyl version of it and, you know, kind of, you know, experience that and deconstruct what it is they're doing. And I think that was a more valuable lesson, akin to what I did with Story and 16 Candles and, you know, breaking everything apart, looking at the pieces, and reinventing it back your way. So when I play music, I'm also telling a story.
Total. That's a really good way to think of it. I do have one more question then, if you don't mind. What should someone listen to if they want to understand jug music? I love string bands and all that old stuff, but I don't know like the history of jug bands too specifically.
I would look up Jim Queskin. Jim, okay. J-I-M, Queskin, K-W-E-S-K-I-N. He's been playing jug music since like the 60s.
Also, he's like one of those people just keeping the tradition alive. Like,
He's the guy. And we as a jug band actually went as like a little field trip to go see him perform. And in the middle of talking, you know, he would say like, you know, these aren't my songs. You know, these are the songs that I learned from guys that were playing them in the 20s and 30s. But the fact is that we keep them alive and we keep changing it up a little bit, and you know, we add our own flavor, but what's important is that we're still having this conversation, you know. That's what keeps the music alive. And we've been lucky, we've been lucky enough to actually play with Jim Queskin, like the legend, at a small like show when he was in the area last year, and we've been invited. We've been invited to the International Jug Band Festival. We played there last year, and we're playing again this year. And it's not some kind of like extravagant like Coachella.
I didn't figure. However,
you know, there's not a lot of jug bands.
That's the thing, right? When people talk about the death of the adventure game or the death of a kind of music or whatever, nothing dies. It just becomes a niche. It becomes something that some passionate people are keeping alive rather than something that everybody is automatically aware of. Yeah. It's still there, and it's still alive, and it's still beautiful, always.
It falls back on the community, right?
Yeah. Like,
those are the things that you find, and those are the things that you build and enrich.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again. This has been delightful for me. I hope it has been for you as well.
Absolutely. This was really great. Thanks so much for inviting me on. If you ever want to like have me back, I'd be more than happy to tell some stories and jokes.
I would love that. This is probably news to you, but you're a bit of a storyteller and you're good at it. So I think I'll take you up on that offer at some point.
All right. Thanks, man.
Have a good one.
Bye.
And that's the show. You can follow Juan on Twitter at Juan Cow. You can find the Telltale back catalog in a rapidly and dismayingly diminishing quantity of places, but you can find the Series app for iOS and Android in the places where you get iOS and Android apps. You can also find Netflix's interactive content on Netflix. This is getting weirder to say as platforms change, isn't it? Also, you can follow Latinx in Gaming on Twitter at Latinos in Gaming, and you can hear Juan's entirely delightful jug band at rivertownskifflers.com. You're also hearing them right now. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, alongside Francis Michelle Lopez and Lucio Valentino. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from the Noun Project, and you can find us on Apple, Stitcher, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Overcast, Breaker, Radio Public, and in any jug that you play your way. Or at etaopod.com.